This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 4th of October, 1955. The title of this lecture is First and Second Postulates in Living. This lecture is 63 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Arrow Productions.
Good morning. I would very much like to talk to you about a number of technical points this morning, which you will run into one kind or another, and which, more importantly, you will inevitably confront as problems you will suppose in research and investigation. And those problems are no longer in research and investigation, and it would be an unkindness to leave a blank. Just as we have now the technology or the theory of native state, first postulate, second postulate, third postulate, fourth postulate, so we have at the same time a great deal of clarification on negative processes. It's about the first thing that we ought to take up with regard to this. Now, of course, in a native state, a thetan is doing nothing. But he could do anything. Just as he knows everything, but specifically does not know something. So, we have the fact that he is not doing anything, but he could do anything. It's quite interesting. Similarly, he is not being anything, but he could be anything. And the oddity is, he has to make the postulate that he is not doing anything, and that he's not being anything, in order to get into the sphere of doing something and being something. Similarly, the problem of havingness. We have the individual in this interesting condition. He is owner of everything. There isn't anything in any universe, much less just this one, that he could not own. You see, there's just nothing he couldn't own. So, he then has to postulate that he owns something. But before he postulates that, he has to postulate that he doesn't own anything in order to own something. And thus we have the old be, do, have material out of Scientology 8-8008, which becomes very important to us today. Becomes more important to us, certainly, than it has ever been before. Now, we all know, taking up beingness, we all know that if we could ask somebody the auditing question, get it across in a real auditing session, what could you be, and get him to change his mind about what he could be, that he would then be able to do and be and have a great many things that he formerly could not. This is an interesting thing. Take the roles that an actor plays. We are all actors to some degree in the game called life, and many of us cannot be the roles to which we are assigned simply because we do not believe we can be these roles, or because we do not want to be these roles, or some other reason. But we are not being many of these roles that we can be. Actually, a well-regulated group depends utterly upon the members of that group being capable, without stress or liability, of being a member of the group. That's terribly obvious, isn't it? But the awful obviousness of it has caused it to escape notice. Let's take an armed service. We have an enormously arduous course of training on the part of the government to make a soldier. It's utterly fantastic, the amount of labor invested in the training of one soldier who is as expendable as confetti. The amount of training invested in one pilot results in 10 years worth of pilot for the government. The cost of training a pilot in these modern times is probably not less than 75,000 pounds. Probably not less than that. And if we were to give him a great deal of specialized training, it might even go on up to $250,000. It's an expensive proposition. The government feels that if it trained them less well than this, that they would be a liability. I give you those figures without ever having consulted the Air Force. I just know what a pilot costs in terms of crash training planes and gray-haired instructors. And in little automaton trainers and quarters and pay and all of this sort of thing. The truth of the matter is the expense of making this pilot is not entirely with the Air Force or the government as such. The important thing is that the cost of this pilot is a cost to the whole society and to his father and his mother and his wife or his sweetheart. And there is a considerable item there. It would be all the dollars if you wanted to be very commercial about it, but much more importantly, all the love and invested affection of all these years up to the time when somebody reaches a long bony finger out and says, "You are it. You are now in the Air Force." Now, pound-wise, they begin to compute his training costs from there. But that isn't where it starts. It starts in the public schools. It starts earlier than that. It starts in the kindergarten. It starts earlier than that. It starts with his nurse. The cost is quite a bit. Particularly if this pilot goes by the boards before his time. If he becomes unable, or if he crashes, or if something happens to him. And right now, the society, the government, is investing without any security at all in a finished product. They do not know, even after they have invested all of this cost of affection and training and all the way up the line, whether or not they're going to have 10 years worth of pilot or not. Of course, the ordinary course of existence is you have 10 years worth of pilot from about 20 to 30, thereabouts, or 23 to 33, and then you have 7 or 8 years worth of operations officer who is not doing any further fast, reliable flying, and then you have, in some lamentable cases, 30 years worth of general or something. I mean, the fellow really degenerates. I mean, he just goes to pieces. he becomes all sorts of interesting things. But he is no longer a pilot, and this is what we started out to have, right? Well, it's interesting that we look at almost any profession, we get this change from one state to another state. Each future state unpredicted. We hope that the state will be such and so. We hope it will, but we can't, as a society at this time, even vaguely guarantee that it will be so. Interesting to note that the reaction time of a human being deteriorates with speed. And it's more interesting to note that modern training and education, and this is where we're arriving right here, brings the reaction time down. That the curve of the declining reaction time and the stress and ardor of his education are the same curve. Oh, there must be something wrong here. And there is. This type of training is not necessarily the best possible method of making a pilot. or a soldier, or a citizen, or a group member. It just plain might be, one way or the other, that the process of education as being followed in creation of professional roles, filling them, isn't the best in the world. Might be that society could know a great deal more about this. And sure enough, it could. Because the stress is continually on making somebody be something in order to make him do something on his hope that he will eventually have something. And that is the normal cycle. And with native state, first postulate, second postulate, third postulate, and fourth postulate, we discover this hideous fact that he could have been a pilot all the time. But that he got to be a pilot this way. He said, now, he said, I am not a pilot. Now I am going to be a pilot. Follow me? He had to say, I am not a pilot, before he could now postulate that he was just this specialized thing, a pilot. Now, let's look at the next stage down. He had to say that he couldn't fly before he could perform the action of flight as a specialized thing done in a certain particular way. This is the maddest thing of all, to tell a Thetan that he cannot fly, or for a Thetan to postulate that he can't fly. He might say, well, I can't fly as a Thetan in the Air Force because I can't mount big enough cannon. But he can certainly fly. If he can do anything, he can do this. And now he has to say, I don't have any money or I don't have any property in order to acquire some property. And look what we've got. We have the be, do, and have scale sandwiched with the impossibility or negative or not postulate prior to be, and then we have the be postulate, and then the negative postulate of an incapability before we get the postulate of capability of do, and then we have the postulate of non-ownership, non-havingness, before we have the postulate of acquisition. And look at this nice scale. Very fascinating thing. And nobody ever articulates the, quote, first postulate, unquote, since those are not first postulates, you see. They are merely the first postulate relating to each condition. They are not the first postulate. It's a very interesting thing that nobody ever articulates these first postulates, really. Never really stresses them, never really talks about them. But only articulates the second postulate in each case. I am now a flight officer. I am now flying. I now have my pay, quarters, a nice wife. See? Well, there's something missing on the ladder. And every time you find something missing in the actual operation, you can assume that it has gone off into an automatic state. Now, you know what automaticity is. Well, the broadest definition of it would be an uncontrolled function. That would merely be a very broad statement of an automaticity. Something which has become automatic. The individual is depending upon it to go on happening without himself causing its going on happening in any way, shape, or form. Everybody, for instance, assumes that this society will just go on running. You know, it's easy, it's running, isn't it? So therefore we assume it's just go on running. The society, therefore, becomes an automaticity to all of its citizenry. And we take some highly categorized welfare state, where nobody has any responsibility for anything, and all you do is take the corn ration and go down and see the games. We expect that society will continue. Well, it does for quite a while, on a very steep dwindling spiral. Very steep. It goes by the boards. Why? Because the function of the society has become an automaticity. And nobody is postulating it, taking responsibility for it, and it becomes without causation and so ceases to exist. And so do all automaticities cease to exist and become dead spots. First, they become very active, and then they drop out of sight, and because they were put on automatic, nobody then knows they ever existed. You have a dependency on the automaticity of speech, and you yourself never talk. Get the idea? Sooner or later, speech would become very automatic, become very uncontrollable. And after a while, you'd stop speaking. Because what is there around to inject any life into anything but life? Nothing is going to come along and inject life into anything but life itself. So, let's look at this bee, do, have, scale again. The way it exists is beingness without causation. Doingness without causation. Havingness without causation. And it's a very peculiar thing where you discover this causation. Very peculiar. The causation is to have these specialized states of be, do, and have. The causation is I am not, I can't do, and I don't have. There is the horsepower behind each of the specializations. So you have a sandwich that looks like this. Automaticity, I am a pilot. Automaticity, I am flying. Automaticity, I have a career. And that's not a very workable sandwich. It's practically inedible. Because you get the individual, after a while, doubting that he is a pilot. That, you see, is not a dynamic fact. It simply is. It's an isness. He is a pilot. Well, of course, if Thetan can be a pilot, he can also be anything else. But he has to say, I am not, before he can say, I am a specialized thing or object. He has to discount his native instinctive ability before he can learn by training a certain pattern of action. This is a real interesting thing. He has to deny any possible share in existence before he can own a particular part of it. You see, what you're overlooking is the fact that the Thetan has a terrible time trying to suppress his own capabilities and possessions to a point where he can specifically be, have, do things. You see, at any moment, you're just liable to fly out, boom, and own the whole world. And boom, on the whole universe. And be playing all sides of all games. You wouldn't have a game if you did that. See, you wouldn't have any game at all. The Democrat has to continually postulate, I am a Democrat, I am a Democrat, I am a Democrat, I am a Democrat. The Royalist has to say, I am a Royalist, I am a Royalist. The pilot has to say, I am a pilot, I am a pilot, I am a pilot. Continually, in order to postulate himself into that position. Well, now, the funny part of it is he can over-postulate this specialization to a point where he's not. You know why? There's a hidden postulate behind being a pilot. It is hidden. And that's the fact that he's not a pilot. And if he doesn't make that postulate once in a while, he'll cease to be a pilot. Because it is automatic, it will materialize. Let's look over this insidious trick. Because it is automatic, it will materialize and take over and drink up the entirety of existence of beingness as a pilot. It's a hidden thing. It's incredible. And I wouldn't tell you this for one moment if it didn't advance auditing and an understanding of life. It isn't reasonable. Neither is it very workable to hide that first postulate. But it's the first postulate that gives the second postulate the strength. The first postulate is the truth by statement. And the second postulate is therefore a lie. So he says, I am not a pilot, I am a pilot. Got this? Which is the lie? The second one is the lie. So he's never going to be a pilot. Not really. He will have sneaking moments when he feels that his capability in the cockpit of this airplane is something which goes unquestioned just because of the stupidity of his own general stance. Many times. He will land that ship and say to himself, sort of, if they only knew. He goes down the street receiving the salutes of airmen. He's an officer. He's a fact. But he knows there's something just a little bit offbeat about the thing. His buttons are never quite bright enough to convince even him. So he begins to sort of be apologetic, and he, you know, returns the salutes. But that's only when the second postulate has begun to twist, and when the first postulate has become totally automatic. And when this first postulate becomes totally automatic, all the actual force behind his being a flight officer vanishes, and he ceases to be one. It's as though that first postulate was capable of ruining, drinking up, wiping out of existence in its entirety, that second postulate. Now, you'll notice this. You'll say, well, somebody was giving me a very nice example of this. He was saying, you know, I ran this first postulate Union Station the other day on myself for about 10 minutes. And I said, chap over here, I said, well, what I don't know about him, I don't know where he works, so he works at the Arcadia Works. Well, he looked at this girl over here and he said, well, what's something I don't know about her? Well, I don't know her name. Her name's Mary. This is what we call the skid. Now, that's an inelegant word, but it doesn't miss describing exactly what's happening. You slip from the one into the other, and that is an automaticity in itself. You'll notice this happening. It's the skid. You make the first postulate, and there's the second postulate. You didn't intend, you see, to make that second postulate at all. You were just going to make the first postulate. So that we say, let's see, what don't I know about the body? We say, well, I don't know how many bones are in it. Well, there's 8,662 bones. Hey, wait a minute. No, I mean, something else I don't know about the body. Don't know how many hairs there are in the head. Well, there are just 1,000 hairs. Get the idea? Well, that is a skid. And when that is occurring on a recognition basis, you can recognize something else about it. And that is that at any moment, the fellow got the idea that he was not a pilot, but he slammed into being one. And he counted on this automaticity occurring until it became totally automatic. And then he didn't skid anymore. He's simply stuck in the second postulate. And in the second postulate, you have a ridge. You don't have any action. Now, how would you restore this fellow's beingness? Some things you are not is an interesting process. You just simply have him take over the automatic postulating of not beingness, am notness. Now, the fact that these things occur is the only reason I'm telling you about them. But the funny part of it is fully interesting enough to examine whether it did anything for a case or not. This is one of the more interesting spheres of action of life. That this fellow's identity as a pilot depends entirely upon his conception that he is not a pilot. It's the most curious thing anybody ever looked at. Fascinating. Impossible. Now we would know what is wrong with somebody's havingness and his doingness. But let's take them in their order downscale, since it's be, do, and have. We find somebody motionless, tired. Now, once upon a time, he was a painter. He just did lots of painting, tremendous quantities. He was also criticized at all the art shows. Every time somebody says, oh, he's really not a painter at all, they made him do a skid. I am a painter. But he never said so, because this is the comment of the opposition. He never stood up in front of the canvas and said, well, I'm not a painter. Never did this. If he had, the first thing he would have recovered probably was weariness on the subject of painting. But if he'd kept it up for a little while, he would have recovered this, an obsession to paint. Boy, his doingness there is obsessive. And if he kept it up a little while longer, saying, I can't paint, that would be the correct one to produce this phenomena, by the way. I can't paint. And the voice said, yes, I can too. And he'd paint. And he'd undoubtedly recover what skills he had earlier. And if he went far enough, he would even run out his education as a painter and become an artist. Because practically the one thing you can't teach anybody to do is to learn how to paint. We can teach lots of things, but we can't teach the arts very well, as universities learn consistently and continually. I think the best part of university training would be in the condemnation by one and all, including the fellow himself, that he was unable to perform that artistic action. Only trouble is, they don't do it enough. If they did it just a little bit more than they did it, they would run it out. Now, I attended one time Geller's acting school for a short space of time. I was very, very interested in the whole business of acting as it seemed to relate in some fashion to existence itself, learning how to act. I found out that about the one thing that you couldn't possibly do was learn how to act. I found any little kid on the street was a better actor than any of the actors being trained. But this particular school was the school to which the big film studios send their fledglings and the kids that are dug up by their talent scouts. And this school has to produce. It just doesn't sit there and do nothing. Otherwise, Warner Brothers and Universal and so forth would stop sending their starlets over there, so they have to produce. And for 3 months after enrollment, we have a totality. We have a totality of can't act. The instructors in that school are the most miserable dogs you ever ran into in your life. They have a kid come up in front of the whole class and do a pantomime. He's supposed to answer the telephone. Now, you know, when you see an actor answer the telephone, you are normally very certain there's somebody on the other end of the line that he is actually engaged in that conversation. See, you're convinced of the actuality of this action. And he picks up the telephone and he starts talking. And the instructor says, "Oh, no." And goes over and mimics the horribleness of the conversation by just overdrawing the entire picture. "Hello, Joe." Very convincing, he will say. Very, very convincing. I liked the intimate character of the whole thing. "May I point out one small fact, however? One, there was no telephone there." They don't even let them hold a live instrument, you see. "Two, there was nobody on the other end of the line at all. And you didn't believe there was. And three, you'll never learn how to act. Take your seat." Miserable. And the morale of these kids for 3 months goes down through the floor. They start to dress less spectacularly. They get up in the morning and the girls wrap an old bandana around uncombed hair and don't even put on any makeup and come down and sit in class. At the end of about 3 months, they go into revolt. And I have seen one of them stand up and give a perfect mimicry of the speech instructor. "Do you realize you're not playing your role as speech instructor? Chin up! Guts in!" That's brash, you know. Since the speech instructor could give them one black mark and it'd finish them with a studio and probably a $500 a week contract. But after 3 months, they have regained the fact that they could act. "But I never knew before this material arose why it was that Gellers taught people how to act. And nobody else knows, and Gellers doesn't know. And one of these fine days, they're going to abandon this program because too many stars are going to be dropped at 2 months deep. And there won't be a school that teaches people how to act there. They will be nice. They will try to sell people on the idea that they're great actors. And the whole thing will be a flop. They're leaving out that first postulate. Marines are Marines because of the ardors with which they are convinced in their training camps that they aren't Marines. Day and night, sergeants and instructors work themselves into a voiceless blather to convince these kids that they will never make a Marine. How could you do this thing? The fellow has a small bit of dust on his bayonet. They just sit around over this thing. How can you do this thing to the core? You will never be a Marine. Well, they found out over the last hundreds of years that you made Marines this way. Believe me, they make Marines. They make Marines so well that once they've made Marines, whether in Great Britain or America, they practically never unbecome Marines. I can see them going down the rest of their lives, generation to generation, picking up Marine babies. Well, how would you go about making somebody be something? How would you go about making somebody do something? How would you go about making somebody have something? Now, let's suppose that we had a singer who had once been. She could sing. Very melodious. hit high G above high C. Easily. Held it for minutes. And one fine day she can't sing. Audience falls off. Nobody listening to her anymore. Voice gone to pot one way or the other. Well, you see, we can explain all this as deterioration of the vocal cords. And that would be all very well, except I doubt very much that great singers use vocal cords. Vocal cords don't do the things that great singers do. I doubt very much. Another thing, we could say, well, her beauty went to pieces. She was no longer beautiful. I have seen some of the ugliest old crocs who could really sing, just holding an audience in complete trance. So that doesn't hold either. It must be that the automaticity of the first postulate on doing this thing called singing became so automatic that it became completely absorbent of the ability to sing. Now it has the power. The fact of singing doesn't have the power. A thetan in his native state has the capability of singing, but not of being and doing a bunch of highly specialized motions called singing, unless he goes into, according to the plan he operates on. You see, there's two things at work here. This is how they do it. There are other ways by which the same thing could be accomplished, but this is how they are doing it. He has to say to himself, now I am not singing. And then he has to say, I am now singing. He has to assume or consider that he is not singing before he assumes that he is. Otherwise, time being non-existent to a thetan, he would be singing all the time or not singing all the time. And in order to get regulation and direction to the thing, he has to specify what he is not and what he is doing. And unfortunately, his first postulate is, I am not singing. And then he says, now I am singing. And having said this, he leaves the other one totally unlooked at. So that we get this thing called persistence of action, persistence of energy pattern. We get this thing called the engram. How? The fellow said, I am not being operated on. Did he? No, he didn't. He said, now I'm going in, and now I am being operated on. After the operation, he very seldom says, now I am not being operated on. No, he's just aware of the fact that he has been operated on. Cute, huh? So we get a persistence of the operation because he never decided to end the operation. He left that to somebody else to decide and so forth. We get persistency of energy patterns. Auditor told me one time, I do very fine with mock-ups, except as I move them around, they leave little trails. Well, naturally they leave little trails. She never said she was not now making a mock-up. She makes a mock-up and then decides that by some automaticity she's going to stop making the mock-up. First, she should say, I'm not making a mock-up. Then she says, I am making a mock-up. Then she would say, I'm not making a mock-up, don't you say? Otherwise, she'll go on making a mock-up, and then all of a sudden the automaticity of the first postulate will drink up the mock-ups, and one of these fine days, she's not making a mock-up, and an auditor will come along, and he will say, make a mock-up. Can't. What's this can't? This can't is the automatic response, which exactly describes their action. Now, here's the great oddity. It doesn't work exactly and smoothly this way for various reasons, because this is too far downscale. This is the first postulate of the third echelon. Doingness resulting in havingness. You could, however, tell somebody not to make a mock-up. All right, decide not to make a mock-up. Good. Decide not to make a mock-up. Decide not to make a mock-up. Decide not to make a mock-up. That's fine. Have you decided not to make a mock-up? Yes, well, I haven't either. Well, good. I mean, you made that one stick. You decided not to make one, and you didn't make one. That's fine. That's real good. Decide not to make a mock-up. Good. Decide not to make a mock-up, and the fellow said, there's a mock-up standing there. Now we say, we've succeeded. All I have to do now to make a mock-up, this fellow says to himself, is say, I'm not making a mock-up, and the mock-up appears, and this is a beautiful system. And this works out for mock-up after mock-up, till he's made four or five, and then he doesn't work anymore. He's not now, see, he put the other thing on. He put making the mock-up on automatic. And of course, he's not saying make a mock-up, you see. He's saying I'm not making a mock-up without following it with now a mock-up will appear. And the oddity is because his own system ceased to work, he's usually stuck with it and feels very depressed about it and doesn't then say mock-up. So he did, he'd get one. You follow me? All actions are then preceded by non-action. All beingnesses are preceded by the postulate of not being them. All havingnesses are preceded by the postulate of not owning. And out of these things, beingness at first exists rather easily. Then the not beingness becomes automatic and drinks up the beingness. Now, if we really worked this over, we'd find out that it probably had many echelons of beingness. You'd probably get one or the other postulates becoming greater or lesser automatic until, all of a sudden, we would get a null on both postulates. Neither one of them would be made. And we'd get the person who walks through life like an automaton. We get the hypnotic subject. Somebody comes along and says to him, you are now a goat. And he says, bah. He's lost his own ability to postulate either side. He's apathy. It's quite interesting that in an apathy case, you know, if you move your hand toward their hand, they will not dodge your hand one way or the other. But if you kept on moving your hand would move through their hand, and they would retain the shape and position which resulted because of your motion and would not restore their hand to the position it was in before you touched it. In other words, here you have mist, here you have putty. Where does this putty come from? On the beingness level, it becomes from the second postulate becoming everything, the first postulate becoming automatic. Then the second postulate being drunk up by the first postulate, making an inability. And then the inability being forced into action again by exterior influences until finally you had a total automaticity until you finally, with that total automaticity, had a nothingness. And you've got putty. You see? One postulate becomes automatic, then the other one becomes automatic, then they both, being automatic, die out. You could get variant degrees and patterns as they did this. You could have one postulate die out, the first postulate, you see, be automatic and then die out, leaving the fellow in this kind of an interesting condition. He is fixedly a bedpost. See that? There's no automatic postulate telling he's not a bedpost. We get all these strange beingness patterns of people. We get neurotic and psychotic patterns and so forth. But we reduce all these things down, we find that they merely depend upon first postulate, second postulate. First postulate becomes automatic, drinks up the second postulate sometimes, and leaving the fellow in an inability. Or the first postulate becomes entirely automatic and dies out, leaving the individual in an obsessive state, unable to withdraw from a beingness. Now you have preclairs who have trouble with bodies, and they're being bodies obsessively. Well, the postulate has died out that they're not bodies. That's left them there, you see. They're like a bit of seaweed stranded by the high tide. And they keep waiting for the tide to come along and take them out to sea again. What tide are they waiting for? I am not a body is the tide they are waiting for. Only they're waiting for somebody else to say it. Why are they waiting for somebody else to say it? Because it never occurred to them to say it. Complicated as this. All right, there's beingness. All right, let's take action. We find the preacler who is in an inactive state has gotten, well, that's the second postulate, has been drunk up by the first postulate. He's in an active state because that is, I am not doing anything. And we find labor, for instance, vacillating between these two things. Do you know the most horrible thing that could happen to labor is for nobody to let them work? That would be a desperate condition. Very desperate for labor there. Committed to a certain line, an economic system. And it just never occurs to government or labor in this day and age that this could occur. And yet the government is taking for granted the role of the entrepreneur and believes that the role of the entrepreneur will continue to exist no matter how hard you tax him. And the entrepreneur, having been put on automatic, now is penalized out of existence and turns into either a criminal or a revolutionary. He can't earn. Who's going to put these laborers to work? This is what somebody ought to be yelling about down in Hyde Park. They ought to be saying, what, who, and where are we going to get jobs tomorrow? Who's going to continue to dream up work? We don't have any department in the government that does. If a government department is erected, as in the United States one was, to dream up work, they dream up silliness. But let's put a lot of fellows to work and have them lean on their shovels. Let's raise the devil with them and fire them off the project if they insist on shoveling. You know, but they dreamed up work. They dreamed up work that was not work, which is identified enough for any government. The Dole system in England was almost as bad. That's the government dreaming up work. Well, actually, they were dreaming up not work. You see, there's practically no work touched on this planet. There's just so many things to do to anybody who can dream up work. So just such limitless lists of things to do that one has a hard time getting down and thinking. By thinking real hard, he can do it, you know, figuring out exactly how is it that anybody could fail to see that there's a great deal of work to be done. So you think this over and you say, well, let's suggest a project. Let's suggest the project of traffic handling in London. Let's, for the first time, have traffic handling in London. Well, you can think of a thousand ways to do it, but you could pour traffic into the center of the city and even route it around the center of the city and out into the country, swish, 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 without cluttering up the streets. But it's quite a bit of work to do that, but that's no reason to prevent it. What you're trying to do is create work. See, you'd have to have elevated planes of some sort. You'd have to have undergrounds, tunnels, and so forth to handle the traffic to get it off the streets because it's too much traffic for the streets. London is getting isolated from parts of London right now just because of the traffic problems. You see, the town is liable to segment itself off much more thoroughly than it has. Traffic problems are getting heavier and heavier. Well, let's just look at this. Here's a problem, and the problem's already there, fully automatic. We could build elevated highways or underground highways in such a degree that we could flip traffic in from the country and to any quarter of London and out again at 90 miles an hour. Wham, wham. See? You'd have to build an awful lot of roadways. Of course, the way they will eventually do it, they will decide that the society has gotten apathetic enough so that you can take anybody's dwelling away from them, and they will just bulldoze straight into the center of town or through all the buildings or something, you know. something like that will occur. That's really what is occurring right now. You know, let's remove all of these dwellings, completely forgetting that this is what this town is for, to live in. Well, now there's an example of doing this, getting on an automaticity, you see. And that's a third dynamic example. Everybody counts. Sooner or later, somebody's going to come along and say, look at all this work. Well, they're just lucky in that occasionally somebody does. But in the United States, the entirety of the Depression depended upon the fact that there were no entrepreneurs around to dream up any work. And when the government took over the task of dreaming up some work, oh my God. In spite of that, there were a half a dozen fellows who actually made themselves non-persona grata with the administration by inventing actual work. Civilian Concentration Corps, for instance, did wonderful work in all directions. Terrific organization. Director after director, shoot them from guns. I mean, doing an efficient job. They're too close to those horrible things called entrepreneurs. Get the tangle you could get any time you set up activity or inactivity on automatic. The tangle you could get into. But the real problem would be in losing the ability to set up things on automatic and then set them off of automatic. See? That would be the real problem. And that is the real problem with people. Nothing is wrong with setting up something as an automaticity. But there's everything wrong with not then being able to take this automaticity and put it back into an actuality and take it out of an automaticity class. We should be able to do both of these things. If you start tearing up a preclear's machinery without rehabilitating his ability to make machinery, he gets unhappy. In mysticism, they have breathing exercises. And without being able to build breathing machinery, they take over the automaticity of all breathing. Result, many mystics have asthma. Many mystics have stopped breathing entirely. I had one sitting in class one day, and I was just showing people what an automaticity was, so I asked people to consciously take three breaths. I had a young chap who had had years of practice with breathing exercises, and he had asthma too. And he promptly got up and went home and lay down in his hospital room and was violently ill for 3 days and required all kinds of injections and so forth. That's all I did. I asked him to take three conscious breaths. Now, there's a case of tearing up somebody's automaticity, his automatic breathing machinery. The machinery must have been hanging by a thread. There must have been just a shadow of it left for three breaths to have torn it up. But this person did not have the ability to put breathing back on automatic again. So you see what would happen if you tore up somebody's automaticities, which is the other side of the problem, without rehabilitating them again. And this is why you must know all there is to know about the first and second postulate. Because you could tear up the automaticity of the first postulate without permitting the individual ever to put it back on automatic again. And this would cause a considerable disruption in the individual. So remember, there are two postulates. There's the first postulate and the second postulate. You've got to give him practice in postulating both of them and exercise in following through after he has postulated them. And he'll find out very readily that he can make these postulates and set them up on automatic and take them off of automatic and put them back on automatic again. So what? The way you put the first postulate on automatic is simply to make the second postulate. The way you put the second postulate on automatic is simply to make the first postulate again. And if they both break down or blow up, then just mock the whole thing up again. Consciously make the first postulate, and then consciously make the second postulate. And you can make it and try, too, you know. You can make it and try hard. Well, that'll really fix you up on a second postulate. You know. You can say, you know, I have no artistic talent whatsoever. I just can't paint. Can't paint at all. It's really regrettable and horrible thing how I campaigned. A Thetan without artistic talents? You see, this is utterly incredible. You really had to get down and sweat over this one when you're in good shape, you know. Let's see, I can't paint. I must have gone blind then. I mean, something must be wrong here if I can't paint. Well, but that's all right. I can't paint. Now, if I tried hard, I can paint. Now, let's see. Let's see, how do you go about painting? You need a brush. See, and we start putting time into it, and the next thing you know, the fellow can paint. Well, now, if he continues along that line after a while, he will skid on his ability, his learned ability to paint, you see. He'll skid back into I can't paint. So just let him skid out of both of them and do it all over again. You find out he can do this so readily that he can kid himself and paint at the same time. He can have the postulate sitting there most gorgeously and feel tremendously sincere about being a painter. And the postulates themselves are the frowsiest pretense imaginable. He can do this. He can paint with his right hand without his left hand knowing that he's an expert. See? Quite curious. A fellow going out and saying, I can't shoot, is only following through the automaticity that back through the centuries, we have, most of us, at one time or another, had to be crack shots. Only survival was so dependent upon being a crack shot that we just never said, I can't shoot. So now, in this generation, you pick up most people and you say, can you handle weapons? And the fellow says, no, I can't handle weapons. He can't handle weapons? What do you mean? This fellow could probably split an apple with a Tower musket a couple of century or so ago. He says, I can't shoot. All right, now let's look at this, what happens with this in lives. Right now, you are being you in this lifetime, right? Well, to a large degree, that depends on your not having lived. And you start to remember your past lives, and every one of those skidded into, I am not living. And that is what happens. Now, this doesn't describe death. This is death. Death comes about as the postulate that one is not living begins to drink up the postulate that one is living. And eventually, that first postulate entirely swallows the second postulate, and we get the phenomenon, death. And every one of your past lives has been swallowed up by the first postulate, I am not living. Now remember that all things are done in present time. They are never done in past time. So the postulate is, I was not living would not exist, you see. It's, I am not living. And you live life after life and skid further and further back into these postulates, and of course you have less and less life that you think you are living, because you are living much more cautiously. For instance, everybody knows today that one only lives one life, and that lives are very precious because they are over and done, and you will never live again. See, they know this. Therefore, you have to be careful, and you have to have slogans up that you mustn't walk in front of traffic, and they start to teach little children to be how to be accident prones. Very early, they give them all these signs and so forth that teach them how to be careful. Those children are going to be murderers when they get to be about 18. See, on a first and second postulate basis, they taught them to be careful. They taught them to be careful. What have they put on total automatic? Being careless. That's on total automatic, and they will become careless. They will become quite reckless. But it will be obsessive recklessness. It's just like people who have had to be careful, who have had to be orderly, who have never dared introduce into the society any chaos of any kind, have never dared introduce into the home any disorder, such as showing and throwing their shoes in the middle of the living room, who eventually become obsessive in the creation of chaos. chaos went on automatic. Order is the thing, and then chaos drinks up order. Before we can produce order, we have to say there was chaos. Isn't this fascinating? You never produced any order out of order. Nobody's ever made orderly things orderly. They've only made chaotic things orderly. Reason can only exist after there has been confusion and no reason. So confusion eventually drinks up reason, and we have insanity. You follow this? Well, now the doors of the secrets of life that many people have advertised and never delivered are quite wide open to you. And I give unto your imaginations how far these postulates go and with what wide consequence you could apply them. First and second postulate is the one fundamental theory. And then we get out of that the actual conditions, native state, first postulate, which is not condition, and second postulate, which is condition. And then we can have artificial conditions, which not is the is condition. And then we can have the is condition, but what's happening here? It's just one or the other postulates going on automatic. And then we get the manifestations of third and fourth postulates, but they really never exist. You are always dealing at all times with native state, first postulate, second postulate. And one or the other of them goes on automatic, or both of them go on automatic. And when they're both totally on automatic, you're dead. In all ways, really, as a Thetan. Because both of them are totally automatic, so therefore the whole business of living is automatic, and it's not automatic at all. So that in itself becomes a lie. A Thetan is his own native state. And until he muddles with this and meddles around with it and so forth, he doesn't become anything else. But of course, to have a game, he does meddle with it. But having meddled with it, he then loses the information that he had originally as how to meddle with it. All we have to do is restore this, and we have a very cleared clear. Thank you.